saving money on everything you need at Menards. Your roof is the first line of defense against the elements, and it enhances the appearance of your home's exterior. Owens Corning shingles offer ultimate protection and impressive curb appeal. Choose from 26 colors of Owens Corning Duration shingles and transform your home today. Shop our selection of roofing products on Menards.com. Plus, check out our weekly flyer and find plenty of great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
Chilling tales for dark nights.
The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs, and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable tales of terror. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show. Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Listener discretion is advised. Hello there, listeners, and welcome back to Horror Hill. I'm Eric Peabody, your host and narrator. And tonight's episode features the return of two authors we've showcased here before, Micah Edwards and Craig Groshek. We'll begin with The Bone Orchard, in which we learn that even the best intentions can have something rotten at their core. Then, to close, we'll be reading God 4, where the assumed benevolence of a higher power is proven to be very, very incorrect. Jeez. I guess we're just knocking down all sorts of comforting pillars with this episode. You're listening to the free edition of this program. If you'd like to help support Horror Hill and also remove these pesky ads, head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. You'll get instant access to hundreds of ad-free stories, so what are you waiting for? Also, if you're watching on YouTube, do us a favor and drop a like and subscribe. Become part of our dark circle, listeners. And now, from author Micah Edwards, I give you The Bone Orchard. There weren't ever any stories about the forest. It wasn't haunted, it wasn't sacred ground. It wasn't anything except a bunch of pine trees and whatever grows under pine trees. Mostly smaller pine trees, as I recall. Pine trees tend to kill off anything else that grows near them, which might explain why that forest existed at all. The point is, it was just a big pine forest covering a couple hundred acres or so. We all grew up playing, fishing, and hunting in it. There was never anything odd about it. No one ever went missing. No one found strange things in the pine cones. It was just a place like any other. Sometime last decade, some fellow named Randy Sommel bought the forest. He wasn't a local. He had been a software developer, I think, or something like that. He'd made his pile of money and decided to retire out to somewhere cheaper, and our slice of the country fit the bill. So he came on out and bought the forest. I imagine he probably paid less for that whole chunk of land than his Silicon Valley house. Certainly, he had money left to throw around afterward. I don't mean to make him sound like a jerk. He wasn't. He didn't try to stop anyone from using the land like we always had. He didn't put up signs about trespassing or anything. He made a point of coming into town and meeting folks and actually getting to be a part of the community. He didn't fit in exactly, but he tried. We all appreciated that. Anyway, there wasn't much point in owning a forest without any sort of place to live, so naturally, the first thing he did was to clear out an acre or so and start putting up a house. A real nice place, filled with all sorts of modern conveniences. Huge picture windows with views of the forest, big kitchen and dining rooms for entertaining, the whole deal. He had folks by on the regular to see it, and while I suppose that he was kind of showing off how much he had, he really was a good host. Randy truly thought he was just going to kick back and relax, come into town to watch the game, have folks over for a dinner party, and enjoy his retirement from age 40 on. But our town isn't what you'd call fast-paced, and in short order, he found himself going a little bit stir-crazy. So, like anyone would, he took up a hobby to occupy his time. He still had plenty of that software money left, though, so his hobby was a little bit bigger than what most folks might have gotten up to. Randy cut down another big swath of that forest, a dozen acres or so, and started an apple orchard. He started almost from scratch, planting seedlings and bringing them up from tiny little sticks. He was proud of not taking the shortcut and bringing in mature trees, said that his were going to be made fully from the ground he'd planted them in, and he didn't mind waiting a few more years for them to grow up the right way. I think most of us thought that maybe it wouldn't be so bad if Randy took a shortcut or two and cut down the amount of apple talk by a couple of years. On the other hand, he tended to buy rounds of cider when he was talking about his upcoming orchard, so mostly, we didn't mind listening. In any case, Andy calmed down after a few months. He was still having the time of his life up in his orchard, and he was happy to show folks around if they wanted to see it. But basically, the next few years were trees getting bigger an inch at a time, and there just wasn't that much to say about it. That all changed when the trees started bearing fruit. I've seen folks who weren't as proud of their newborn children as Randy was of those first apples. He came into town with a wooden bushel full of them, just like it was 100 years ago, handing apples out to anyone who glanced in his direction. As far as I know, no one noticed anything wrong with them that day. Of course, we were all just eating them the way you eat apples, taking bites around the outside and throwing out the core when you're done. No one was cutting them open then. So probably, the first ones were the same, and we just never knew. Despite all the time Randy spent in that orchard, he hadn't figured out what to do with the apples when the first crop came in. He didn't have anyone to sell them to. He didn't have a full-sized cider press set up. He just had a dozen acres of trees, all bearing fruit at once. So, he kept picking those apples and bringing them into town, telling us to enjoy them now before he started charging, and pretty soon we were all swimming in apples. You can only eat so many apples raw, so folks started cooking and baking with them. Within about a week, the whispers were starting. No one wanted to sound ungrateful, rude, or, worst of all, strange, so it was all carefully couched in deniable language. People were all asking the same sort of question, though. Had anyone noticed anything odd about the apples, specifically in the cores? It turned out a lot of us had. It took a lot of hemming and hawing and, well, it looks like, but eventually word got around. That white, stick-like thing in the core of the apple wasn't unique. It was in almost every apple grown in Randy's orchard. And it didn't just look like a fragment of bone. It was one. We were real unsure about that last bit at first, and no one wanted to be the first person to say that they'd found a bone in their apple. Mostly, they were just slivers, little broken bits that could have been anything, really. Twigs, some kind of odd growth, something normal like that. But a couple of folks found ones that were pretty clearly knuckle bones, and at least one opened up an apple to find a hollow little bone that ended in a knee joint. Looked like it had been snapped off of a bird or something. None of the apples were damaged in any way. No one was sneaking these bones inside of them or anything weird like that. We started checking carefully before cutting them open, and those apples were pristine and unblemished. They'd grown around the bones. People were starting to kick around some wild ideas, like ghost trees and carnivorous apples snatching birds out of their nests. The next time Randy came into town with a pile of apples to give away, he noticed that folks were a lot less willing to take them than they had been. "What's the matter?" he asked. "Hope I haven't appled you folks out already. There's a lot more coming. We're going to be in trouble if you've already hit your limit." He was all smiles and excitement still. He had no idea what was going on. Telling him was going to be like kicking a puppy, but we knew we had to do it. And besides, maybe he had a normal explanation for the bones in the cores of his apples. I know that sentence sounds insane, but we all hoped it might be true. You can tell yourself some odd things when you're trying to avoid the truth. Randy did not have a good explanation for why his apples had bones in their cores. He didn't even believe us at first. We had to cut one open and show him, and then he still thought it was some kind of a trick. He took one himself, picking it from the middle of the basket, as if he suspected us of changing out the ones on the top, and cut it carefully down the middle. The bone that fell out of that apple was the clearest one yet. It didn't look like an animal bone like the others. It was cracked in half, but despite that, it was very obviously the top joint of a human finger. Everyone was eyeing Randy pretty suspiciously at this point, and he was giving the eye right back. We called in the sheriff by unspoken mutual agreement. This was well beyond what town gossip and whispers could sort out. We needed the law. Sheriff Morley was pretty unhappy about the entire situation. It was complicated and confusing, and it wasn't exactly clear what crime had been committed. Obviously, it had to be illegal to give people apples with bones. That sort of thing couldn't possibly be allowed. It's just that it was a little hard to find a specific statute to point to forbidding it. Just like the rest of us, though, Morley had eaten several of those apples. He didn't appreciate learning that he'd accidentally put something strange in his mouth. So he was motivated to find some reason why whatever was going on with Randy's apples wasn't okay. After a little digging around, he told Randy that he was investigating his orchard for violations of the Nutrition Labeling Act, and he was going to need to go look around up there immediately. It probably wasn't a reasonable citation. After all, who's ever seen an apple with a nutrition sticker? But it sounded official, and Randy wasn't inclined to fight it. He wanted to get to the bottom of this as much as any of us. More so, in fact, since it was his orchard that was tainted. We'd all just had a few apples to deal with. This had been Randy's passion for the last half decade. For him, this wasn't just a complaint about some oddities in the fruit. It was a personal attack. Morley offered to wait until the weekend to come look through the orchard, but Randy insisted he come up right then. "I'll be taking one right off of the tree when I get back," said Randy. "You might as well be there with me to see it. If this is some kind of hoax, I'll be glad to have a witness that my apples aren't the problem. And if they aren't, I guess I'm going to need all the help I can get figuring out what's going on. So bring anyone you like. We're going up now to figure this out." Turned out that most of the town was interested in unraveling the mystery. We all piled into various cars and followed the sheriff and Randy out to his house. The driveway was never meant to handle that many vehicles at once, but we all angled onto the grass at the edges and made it work. Then we realized it was still a bit of a hike out to the orchard, so while Randy and the sheriff took his golf cart out along the track, the rest of us crammed into the backs of a few pickup trucks and rode out after them. This is all to show the sort of quiet chaos lurking in the background. It wasn't a problem yet, but it was the sort of thing that could easily become a problem if anything went wrong. We were all too fixated on the apples to think that far ahead, though. The whole procession rolled up to the first tree. Randy got out with an apple picker and pulled a fruit down straight off the tree. We all saw the branch bend when he pulled it and then bob back up as the apple popped free. The fruit had grown there, sure enough. Sheriff Morley took a knife and cut the apple in half. Nestled in the center, neat as could be, was a human tooth. It was a molar, missing one of its roots in a jagged break. It had no business being inside of an apple.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
I don't understand, said Randy. He spoke for all of us, really. Up until that very moment, I think we'd all been holding out hope that this was a joke, a trick, or some sort of insane prank. But we'd all seen the apple come down together. We'd crowded around and watched as the sheriff turned it over and cut it open. It was whole before he took the knife to it. The only way that apple could have had a tooth inside of it was if the tree had put it there itself. Randy went to another tree, then another, then another. We all trailed along behind, watching as he took an apple from each one and split it open to reveal a new bone. Some were just tiny fragments, looking more like toothpicks than anything structural. Others were almost whole. There were big ones and little ones, pieces of fingers and toes, and of wings and spines. The only thing they had in common was that none of them belonged inside of an apple. Finally, maybe 15 trees in, Randy found one that didn't have anything inside of it except apple seeds. The look of relief on his face was comical. "They're not all like that," he said, pulling down another apple and cutting it open. "Look, this one's normal too. It's not the whole orchard. Whatever's going on here, it's not all of the trees." We all shoved in close enough to see the apple in Randy's hand. Sure enough, it was perfectly ordinary inside. We passed it around, examining it carefully, as if maybe the bones were hidden behind the seeds. The sheriff, meanwhile, wandered over to tap on the tree and try to figure out what made this one different from the previous ones. Something in the roots caught his eye, and he crouched down to scratch at the soil, pulling away clumps of grass. "You put this one on rocks?" he asked Randy. "Could be that's what's keeping the bones out." "I had this entire area tilled to tear up all the pine stumps and roots," Randy said. "There shouldn't be any sizable rocks left."
"Big, milky quartz-looking thing," said Morley, rapping on a piece he'd exposed.
"Huh. Sounds hollow. What kind of..."
Everyone went quiet at once. The sheriff knocked on the rock in front of him again. It was definitely hollow. We couldn't see much of it sticking out of the ground, but the same thought occurred to everyone at the same time. This was a skull.
"Get me a shovel," he said quietly. "If this is human, this is now crime scene."
The sheriff probably should have cleared us all out then, but I suppose he realized he'd have a riot on his hands if he tried it. Randy went tearing off back toward his barn and came back a few minutes later, riding in a big yellow digger that barely fit down the row. It knocked branches aside as it came, sending apples rolling freely across the ground. I pictured the bones inside of them bouncing and tumbling, rattling against the cores. I wondered if the skull we were about to see was human. I could only imagine what it all meant. I came up empty and stared along with everyone else, waiting to see what would be revealed.
"What'd you bring that huge thing for?" Morley asked as Randy drove up. "You can't dig this up with that. It'd smash it all to bits."
Randy tossed a shovel to the sheriff and climbed down from the digger, letting it idle.
"Something's going on under my trees," he said.
You can dig that skull up carefully first, but after that, I'm making a big hole to see what's behind all of this. The tree roots were tangled everywhere the sheriff tried to dig, but after a couple of tries and a bit of inventive swearing, he managed to get the blade of the shovel under the skull and lever it out of the ground. It popped free in a shower of earth, but even before the sheriff lifted it up, it was obvious that it was a deer skull. We all let out a collective breath. From the small bit of the curve we'd seen, I'd been certain it was human. It was both a disappointment and a relief. It's still a bizarre thing to find tangled in the roots of an apple tree, but it wasn't human remains, and that was comforting, in a way. "It's just a deer," said Morley. He sounded as relieved as the rest of us. "That one is," said Randy, peering into the small hole. The sheriff's head snapped around. "What?" "There's another one under it. Look, past that big root." The sheriff did his best, jabbing and chopping at the thick roots, but this one was too far under the tree to retrieve with the shovel. "Step back," said Randy, who'd climbed back into the digger. "I'll see what's under the tree." We all backed up a step as he dropped the scoop into the ground and started to dig. The teeth bit into the thick tree roots, scarring and mangling them. He pulled the scoop back up, scattering broken roots and dirt everywhere, and along with it, dozens of skulls in all sizes. Most of them belonged to animals. At least two were human. "There's more down there," called Randy, sending the scoop back into the ground. The next hall seemed to contain more bone than earth. The skulls spilled out everywhere, hundreds of them this time. They were shattered and fragmented from their unceremonious retrieval, but again, several human skulls were obvious in the mass. "Stop digging!" shouted Morley, but Randy was already going in again. "There's more down there!" he cried. "Wait! There's something moving!" The digger jerked as if caught on something, and then tilted forward. Randy yanked back on the controls, but it hung in place, straining against an unseen force. It stayed that way for several seconds before suddenly lurching backward, released from whatever titanic grip had held it. It crashed into another tree, ripping its roots from the earth and knocking it askew. As the roots sprung free from the ground, we had a glimpse of something massive tangled in them. I thought for a moment that it was just more collected bones, but then it moved in one long, snake-like mass. It was as thick around as a man's waist, and I saw at least 20 or 30 feet of length whip by as it vanished back into the ground. The entire structure was composed of bones, from human femurs and spinal columns to tiny mouse ribs, all deftly arranged into a single, flexible unit. The bones in it were not broken like the ones we had been finding in the apples. They were strong and whole, worthy of being put to use. Something was not just collecting the bones, but selecting them. It was building something new underneath the soil. It was somehow using the trees to remove its discards. None of this made any sense. It wasn't even properly something I thought about. It just crashed through my mind like the bone tentacle itself, a small piece of something much larger. I was already running before the thing under the ground disappeared. So was most of the town. The ones who'd driven their trucks to the orchard didn't wait for the passengers to climb aboard. They floored the pedals as soon as the engines started. Dirt fountained from spinning wheels as everyone stomped on their gas pedals. People screamed as they were knocked aside by fishtailing vehicles, thrown from truck beds, and crushed beneath tires. No one stopped to help anyone up. Those who didn't make it into the trucks just kept running. None of us looked back. No bodies turned up that day, though I can count 7 people missing from town, the sheriff among them. I don't know why that feels like it matters more than the others. I suppose it's because he was in charge, the one responsible for uncovering the truth. Taking him Well, I guess that means that whatever is under the orchard is in control now. I thought maybe Randy would cut down the orchard, burn it to the ground, or move away. Instead, he's had delivery trucks coming up to his house recently. I sneaked a peek. It looks like he's finally getting that full-scale cider press installed, the system for processing all of those thousands of apples at a time. The mashers and the filters on it look pretty solid. I imagine if they can handle the stems and seeds and cores of the apples, they could probably remove all sorts of other fragments as well. Doesn't matter what goes in. Cider comes out. The rest of the slurry goes right back into the orchard. Bone meal makes excellent fertilizer. You've been listening to The Bone Orchard by Micah Edwards. Micah Edwards graduated from William & Mary with a degree in English and no particular plans to use it. He now finds himself occupying various roles as an author, a comedian, and a database administrator, depending on the day of the week. He resides in Richmond, Virginia, the world's premier home of authors named Micah Edwards. And now, from author Craig Groshek, I give you God 4. Part 1. My name is Elias Grayson, and until 5 years ago, I believed in God. Not the vague, modernist platitude of some benevolent creator, nor the cynical skepticism of a philosopher hedging his bets. I believed in a God with capital letters, the Almighty, the Father, the Maker of heaven and earth. I was a priest, until I wasn't. There's a saying that science and faith are enemies, but I never saw it that way. My faith drove me to science. I wanted to understand how the mechanics of creation worked. Where others saw contradiction, I saw harmony. God set the stars spinning, I told my parishioners, and physics is the language he wrote it in. But the church disagreed. It began with my papers. Long, detailed treatises blending theology and cosmology, proposing that the Big Bang could be seen as divine fiat and quantum mechanics as proof of a creator's fingerprints. I thought I was building bridges, but my superiors saw heresy. They demanded a retraction, and when I refused, they escalated. I was excommunicated 6 months later. My faith didn't survive the betrayal. 5 years after leaving the collar behind, I worked in the astronomy department of a small university. My days were spent juggling grant proposals and lecturing undergrads who cared more about passing exams than looking at the stars. It was a quieter life, but a hollow one. That's when he came. I remember the man who approached me clearly, probably because everything about him felt like a caricature of clandestine government types. He had the black suit, the mirrored sunglasses, and the stiff gait of someone who had never blended in anywhere. He didn't introduce himself. "Dr. Grayson?" "Yes?" "You're requested for a classified project. It's an opportunity that aligns with your unique expertise. May I sit?" He didn't wait for permission, lowering himself into the chair opposite my desk and sliding a sleek black folder toward me. "Who are you?" I asked, keeping my voice calm despite my apprehension. He didn't answer. Instead, he gestured toward the folder. "You'll find everything you need in there. Read it carefully. If you're interested, there's a car waiting outside." It wasn't a request, and the weight in his tone carried more authority than the church ever had. The folder was unmarked, and its contents were anything but ordinary. Diagrams of strange machines, photographs of ancient manuscripts, and a single question scrawled in bold type across the top page. "Does God exist?" There were other pages, too, detailing the terms of the project, security clearances, a staggering salary, and a clause that essentially signed my life away. It was absurd, like something from a spy novel, but the question lingered in my mind. I had spent my life trying to reconcile science and faith. Here was an opportunity to chase the ultimate answer. I had told myself that I didn't care anymore, but at that moment, I realized the ember of my curiosity had never fully died. I didn't need much time to decide. By the time I walked out of my office, the black sedan was waiting at the curb. The facility was somewhere in the mountains, though I couldn't tell you where. The car's windows were tinted too dark to see through, and when we arrived, they blindfolded me before leading me inside. It was a strange combination of high-tech sterility and Gothic architecture. Labs bristling with equipment sat beside halls lined with statues and murals of gods both familiar and obscure. I wasn't the only one there. The team was an eclectic mix. Physicists, theologians, mystics, and even a historian specializing in pre-Abrahamic religions. They introduced themselves in clipped, professional tones. Everyone referred to me simply as Dr. Grayson. After a brief orientation, I was led to my quarters, a Spartan room with a single bed, a desk, and a terminal connected to a secure network. A man in a lab coat handed me a keycard and a small tablet loaded with classified documents. "Your first assignment," he said, "is to familiarize yourself with the basic premise. You'll find the term God 4 mentioned frequently. I suggest you pay close attention." "God 4?" I asked. But he didn't answer. Instead, he left me standing in the hallway, clutching the tablet. I spent that first night reading until my eyes burned. The documents were dense and unsettling, blending cutting-edge physics with references to ancient texts and rituals. At first, the premise seemed absurd, that God was not a singular entity but a recurring force manifesting in different forms over eons. These manifestations were said to embody distinct divine aspects: creation, detachment, compassion, and now God 4, an iteration described as the embodiment of wrath and destruction. The project's purpose, I learned, was to study these cycles to determine their impact on the universe and, if possible, uncover patterns that could help us understand their purpose or prevent catastrophe. The last file I read was a transcript of a briefing given to the project's lead scientists. God 4, the transcript read, is the culmination of all prior cycles. It is wrath incarnate, chaos distilled. Its arrival will not be subtle. It will be catastrophic, ushering in a purge of imperfection to prepare the universe for the rebirth of Cycle 1. The words sent a chill down my spine. Despite my cynicism, I felt something stir in me, a shadow of the faith I thought I'd abandoned. Could this be real? Could the God I'd worshipped as a priest be but one iteration of a much larger, far stranger truth? I slept fitfully that night, haunted by fragments of scripture that now took on an ominous new meaning. I am Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end. The first days in the facility blurred together, a surreal mixture of cutting-edge science and ancient superstition. Every morning began with briefings that would have sounded insane to anyone outside those walls. Updates on quantum field experiments, analyses of sacred particles, and progress reports on rituals reconstructed from forgotten civilizations. My task was to bridge the two worlds, to find the common thread between the divine and the physical. The others, those mystics, theologians, and occultists, treated the supernatural as fact, while the physicists relied on data and math. I straddled the line, as I always had. But as I dove deeper into the work, the line between science and mysticism began to blur. The first breakthrough came 3 weeks in, during an experiment I had initially dismissed as pseudoscience. A team led by Dr. Lorena Choi, a theoretical physicist with an unnerving fascination for Kabbalistic symbolism, had devised a mechanism they called the resonance array. The device was a monstrous hybrid of particle accelerators and arcane symbols designed to detect anomalies in quantum fields. The idea, according to Lorena, was simple. If God had ever acted upon the universe, traces of those actions might still exist, embedded in the fabric of reality. "It's like finding fingerprints at a crime scene," she explained during the briefing. "Except the crime scene is existence itself." I was skeptical, but curious. The experiment involved bombarding a sealed chamber with high-energy particles while chanting verses from the Rig Veda, an ancient Hindu text. The chants, Lorena argued, served as a metaphysical key to unlock divine interactions. It sounded absurd, but the results were undeniable. As the chanting reached its crescendo, the monitors spiked with data, bursts of energy that defied known physical laws. The chamber began to glow faintly, and the air hummed with an otherworldly resonance. I stood in stunned silence as Lorena turned to me, a triumphant smile on her face. "We're not just looking for God," she said. "We're touching him." That night, I reviewed the data with a growing sense of unease. The energy signatures didn't match any known phenomenon. It was as if the universe itself had momentarily warped, responding to the experiment in ways I couldn't explain. The old theological debates I'd had as a priest came to mind. What if God wasn't an omnipotent creator, but something far stranger? Something woven into the very fabric of existence, capable of manipulating it at will. I went to bed with a throbbing headache, my mind racing with possibilities. The days that followed brought more revelations and more questions. One experiment involved a 4,000-year-old Sumerian prayer tablet, which was placed in a magnetic containment field designed to amplify subtle energy patterns. As the tablet was exposed to the field, the containment chamber began to vibrate, emitting a low, guttural sound that resembled chanting. Another test utilized a ritual dagger from an obscure Celtic sect, believed to have been used in sacrificial offerings. When placed under an electron microscope, the blade's surface revealed microscopic inscriptions, symbols that matched those found in carvings on opposite sides of the globe. Patterns began to emerge. Every culture, every religion, every ancient myth seemed to point to the same truth, that the divine was real, but fractured. Each piece of evidence felt like a shard of a shattered mirror, reflecting only a fragment of a much larger whole. But the most unsettling discovery came during what we called the divine fragment retrieval. The retrieval process involved isolating and amplifying energy anomalies detected by the resonance array. These anomalies, Lorena theorized, were remnants of divine actions, traces left behind by past incarnations of God. The first fragment was subtle, manifesting as a faint distortion in light patterns. The second was more pronounced, producing an audible hum that set our teeth on edge. But the third was something else entirely. It happened during a late-night session with only a skeleton crew present. The chamber housing the resonance array began to glow brighter than ever before, pulsing with a rhythmic intensity. The hum grew louder, resonating deep in our bones. And then, for a brief moment, we saw something. It was impossible to describe, a shape that defied logic, folding and unfolding in ways that hurt to look at. Colors I couldn't name swirled around it, and its surface seemed to ripple like liquid glass. I could feel its invasive presence penetrating my mind. One of the mystics fell to his knees, muttering a prayer in a language I didn't recognize. Lorena stared in awe, tears streaming down her face. I couldn't look away. For the first time in years, I felt something akin to faith, a desperate, terrifying certainty that we were in the presence of something greater than ourselves. The aftermath of the experiment was chaotic. The shape vanished after only a few seconds, leaving behind scorched equipment and frayed nerves. Debriefings were tense. Half the team wanted to shut down the experiments, claiming we were tampering with forces we didn't understand. The other half, led by Lorena, argued that we were on the brink of a breakthrough. I found myself caught in the middle. The rational part of me knew the risks were escalating, but a deeper part, the part that had once worn a priest's collar, felt an insatiable need to continue. I spent hours poring over the data, trying to make sense of what we'd witnessed. The patterns were clear. These fragments weren't random. They were pieces of something larger, something coherent. That's when I stumbled upon an obscure file buried in the classified archives. The Cycles of God, Advanced Analysis. The document didn't rewrite what I already knew about the cycles. It deepened it. It contained data and observations that the project leads hadn't disclosed to the team, possibly for fear of inciting panic. The file suggested that the cycles were not just sequential events, but part of a self-sustaining cosmic mechanism, one designed to purge and renew existence. It also included chilling timelines and predictions. God 4's arrival was not an abstract possibility, but a near certainty, calculated to occur within weeks. The file's final pages hinted at something even more disturbing. Not all cycles followed the same patterns. Cycle 4, they suggested, was anomalous, its destructive intensity potentially surpassing anything that had come before. The implications were clear. This wasn't just the end of a phase. It could be the end of existence as we knew it. What made the file unsettling wasn't its theories, but its implications. The researchers who authored it had gone further than anyone else, charting the patterns of destruction that accompanied each cycle and predicting what cycle 4 would bring. Their conclusion was stark, underscored by a final, dire warning. Cycle 4 is imminent. It will not be kind. The words troubled me in a way the earlier briefings hadn't. It was one thing to discuss theory in abstract terms. It was another to see the evidence laid out so plainly, alongside the unmistakable certainty of what was to come. That night, I couldn't sleep. My dreams twisted into a kaleidoscope of distorted shapes, fragments of scripture, and whispers I couldn't place. They all seemed to coalesce into a single, nightmarish thought. When I awoke, my lips moved before I even realized I was speaking. Behold, I make all things new. The verse, straight from the biblical book of Revelation, echoed in my mind. The words no longer felt like a promise. They were a threat. Part 2. The mood in the facility shifted after the experiment with the third fragment. We all felt it, a mounting tension that crept into every conversation, every glance exchanged in the sterile hallways. For some, it was a thrill. For others, a quiet dread. For me, it was both. I buried myself in work, dissecting the data from our latest experiments and looking for patterns that might offer some sense of control. But control was an illusion. The fragments weren't random anomalies. They were pieces of a puzzle we weren't meant to solve. And yet, we kept going. The warning signs began as subtle anomalies, bursts of gamma radiation from nowhere, unexplained gravitational shifts near the facility, and a rise in seismic activity that couldn't be attributed to any tectonic fault. The data was clear. Something was building. Something massive. Then, the dreams started. At first, I dismissed them as stress-induced nightmares, but when I overheard two colleagues describing eerily similar visions, endless spirals of color, a voice speaking a language that seemed older than time, I realized I wasn't alone. It wasn't just dreams, either. Some team members reported auditory hallucinations, faint whispers that seemed to come from the walls or the air itself. Others claimed to see fleeting shapes in their peripheral vision, too quick to identify, but impossible to ignore. The first casualty silenced even the most skeptical among us. Dr. Miguel Torres, a materials scientist with a sharp wit and an even sharper tongue, had been vocal about his disdain for the project's mysticism. "God for?" he'd scoffed during one meeting. "Sounds like the title of a bad sci-fi movie." No one saw what happened to him. He'd been working late in one of the isolated labs, analyzing energy signatures from the resonance array. When he didn't show up for the morning briefing, a security team was sent to check on him. What they found defied explanation. The lab was intact, but Miguel was gone. All that remained was a scorched outline of his body on the floor, as if he'd been burned into the ground by an impossibly intense light. The security footage showed only static during the time of his disappearance. It wasn't long before the rumors began. Some claimed he'd been taken by God for a punishment for his lack of faith. Others whispered that he'd stumbled too close to the truth and had been erased for it. I didn't know what to believe, but Miguel's fate was a warning. That much was clear. The final breakthrough came a week later. Lorena and her team had been working on a method to amplify the fragment's energy signatures, hoping to force a direct manifestation of God 4. The risks were astronomical, but desperation had overtaken caution. "We're running out of time," she told me during a tense meeting. Her voice was calm, but her eyes betrayed her fear. "The signs are accelerating. If we don't act now, we might not get another chance." Against my better judgment, I agreed. The experiment took place in the main chamber, a cavernous space lined with reinforced walls and bristling with equipment. The resonance array had been upgraded, its circuitry glowing with an unsettling, almost organic light. As the experiment began, I stood in the observation room, overwhelmed with anticipation and dread. Lorena and her team worked frantically at their consoles, chanting fragments of scripture alongside incomprehensible equations. The air grew heavy, charged with an energy that made every hair on my body stand on end. The lights flickered, and the hum of the machinery rose to a deafening roar. And then, it happened. The chamber was suddenly bathed in a searing, otherworldly light. The monitors went wild, displaying readings that defied comprehension. And in the center of the chamber, something began to take shape. It was impossible to describe. A mass of shifting geometries, constantly folding and unfolding upon itself, like a living fractal. Colors I'd never seen before danced across its surface, and its form seemed to pulse with a rhythm that resonated deep in my chest. The voice followed, a soundless vibration that bypassed the ears and spoke directly to the mind. "I am." The words were simple, yet they carried a power that rivaled the intensity of 1,000 stars. Lorena collapsed to her knees, tears streaming down her face. Several others followed, their expressions a mixture of awe and terror. I remained standing, though my legs felt like they might give out at any moment. The entity's presence was overwhelming, its consciousness pressing against mine like an ocean threatening to drown a single drop of water. And yet, I felt a strange clarity. This was God 4. The voice continued, resonating with an authority that left no room for doubt. "I am Wrath. I am the scourge of imperfection. I am the harbinger of purity." Images flooded my mind, worlds burning, galaxies collapsing into themselves, life reduced to ash and dust. It wasn't just humanity at stake, it was everything. The universe itself would be purged, stripped bare to make way for the next cycle. And yet, there was a twisted logic to it. The destruction wasn't malicious. It was necessary, a cleansing fire to prepare the cosmos for renewal. I wanted to scream, to beg for mercy, but the words wouldn't come. "You will witness. You will remember." The entity's light flared, blinding and absolute. When it faded, the chamber was empty, the equipment fried, and the walls charred. But the entity was gone. For a moment, there was silence. Then Lorena whispered, her breath trembling, "It's coming." The aftermath was chaos. Half the team quit on the spot, refusing to continue what they called a doomed endeavor. The rest of us were left to pick up the pieces, trying to make sense of what we'd unleashed. But the signs were undeniable. The anomalies were escalating, the dreams growing more vivid. The end was no longer a distant possibility. It was imminent. I spent hours in the archives, poring over every scrap of data, every ancient text, looking for a way to stop what felt inevitable. But the more I learned, the clearer it became. There was no stopping Godfar. The cycle would continue, as it always had, and we were powerless to change it. The first thing I noticed was the silence. Not the absence of sound, but a suffocating stillness that made every breath feel like a transgression. The facility had fallen into a tense, reverent quiet in the days following the experiment. Even the air seemed heavier, as though we were intruding on something far greater than ourselves. The final briefing came without warning. A terse message on my terminal ordered me to report to the resonance chamber. There were no details, but I knew what it meant. It was time. The chamber was unrecognizable. The machinery had been stripped down and rebuilt into something grotesque, a fusion of modern technology and ancient ritual. Circuitry wound through carved stone, and symbols from a dozen religions were etched into every surface. The air was thick with the smell of burning incense and the faint metallic tang of ozone. Lorena stood at the center of the room, her hands trembling as she made the final adjustments to the resonance array. Her face was pale, her eyes sunken, but there was a determination in her expression that bordered on zealotry. "This is it," she said, her voice barely above a whisper. "We've isolated the final fragment. If this works, we'll have full contact with God IV. I nodded, unable to trust my voice. I felt as if the air had been squeezed from my lungs. The team gathered around the control consoles, their faces a mixture of fear and grim resolve. Lorena raised her hand, signaling for silence. "Begin the sequence," she said. The chamber came alive with a low hum, the machinery thrumming with energy. Lights flickered erratically, and the symbols engraved into the stone began to glow, their light pulsing in time with the hum. I felt it, forcing its way into our world. Before I saw it, the air grew colder, and the hum deepened into a resonant vibration that seemed to reach into the very core of my being, pulling at something primal. Then the light came. It started as a faint shimmer in the air, a distortion that rippled like heat waves. But it grew, intensifying until the entire chamber was bathed in an unearthly radiance. The light was alive, shifting and folding in on itself, its colors defying description. And in the center of the chamber, something began to take shape. It was not a form that belonged to this world. Its geometry was impossible, its dimensions fluctuating in ways that hurt to look at. Every time I thought I could grasp its shape, it changed, slipping through the cracks of my understanding. The colors that swirled across its surface weren't colors at all, but something deeper, something that seemed to bypass my eyes and sear directly into my mind. And then there was the voice. "I am Wrath." The words didn't come from the entity itself, but from everywhere at once. They weren't heard so much as felt, resonating in my bones, my blood, my soul. "I am the end. I am Genesis." I fell to my knees, trembling. Around me, I saw others doing the same, their faces pale with terror. Lorena was sobbing, her hands clutching at her chest as though trying to keep her heart from bursting. The entity pulsed, its form shifting faster, growing larger. Its light filled the chamber, spilling out into the observation room and beyond.
All is imperfect. All must be purged.
Then came the images, flooding my mind in a torrent of horror. I saw worlds crumbling into dust, stars imploding into voids of absolute darkness. I saw the earth itself split open, oceans boiling away as fire consumed the land. And I saw myself standing on the edge of a great abyss, my hands reaching out toward something unseen. The abyss stared back, promising annihilation and rebirth in the same breath. The voice returned.
"You will remember."
The words echoed in my mind as the light began to fade. The entity's form dissolved, collapsing in on itself until nothing remained but the faint thrumming of the machinery. When it was over, the silence returned, deeper and more oppressive than before. No one spoke. We simply sat there, staring at the empty chamber. Lorena was the first to move, standing on unsteady legs and turning to face the rest of us. "It's done," she said, her voice hollow. "We've seen it. We know." But her words brought no comfort. The knowledge was a burden none of us were prepared to carry. We had called forth God IV, and it had answered. And nothing had changed. Part 3. We didn't know how quickly it would happen. There were debates among those of us who remained in the facility, most of which felt more like desperate rationalizations. Did we have days? Months? Could we, perhaps, measure the time remaining in years? It took less than a week. The first signs were subtle but undeniable. The stars began to shift. Constellations warped into unfamiliar patterns, their light bending in ways that shouldn't have been possible. Astronomers at the facility scrambled to calculate trajectories, but there was no logic to the alterations. It was as if the sky itself was being rewritten. Reports from the outside world filtered in, fragmentary and surreal. Coastal cities experienced inexplicable tidal waves, their harbors reduced to ruins without a single tremor beneath the sea. Deserts bloomed with flowers that withered into ash within hours. The auroras, ordinarily confined to polar regions, swept across the globe, bathing everything in an eerie, shifting glow. And it wasn't just Earth. Telescopes trained on deep space captured galaxies unraveling like frayed threads, their light dimming until only darkness remained. The entire universe was collapsing, piece by piece, and there was nothing we could do about it. The dreams grew worse. I saw myself walking through ruinous landscapes, endless wastelands dotted with the remnants of a once thriving world. Buildings stood half submerged in sand, their rooftops broken and crumbling. Rivers of molten metal carved paths through desolate plains, the sky above a churning mass of black and red. In every dream, the voice was present.
"Behold the new order."
It spoke with a finality I couldn't escape, each word searing my thoughts, carving itself into my mind. The others began to break. Lorena was the first. Her brilliance, her zeal, had all crumbled. I found her in her quarters, sitting on the floor with pages of scrawled equations and prayers spread around her like a shrine. She looked up at me with hollow eyes and whispered, "We were never meant to know." I wanted to comfort her, but couldn't find the words. What could I possibly say? That it would be okay? That we'd survive this? It would have been a lie, and she would have known it. The next morning, she was gone. No note, no explanation, leaving behind an empty room and the faint smell of burned paper. Others followed suit. Some fled, trying to return to lives that no longer existed. Some simply stopped showing up to briefings, disappearing into the labyrinthine corridors of the facility, and were never heard from again. By the end of the week, I was one of the last still standing. The final event began without warning. I was in the observation room, reviewing footage from the resonance chamber, when the alarm started. A piercing wail echoed through the facility, accompanied by the flickering of the overhead lights, and I rushed to the central command center. The monitors displayed chaos. Outside the facility, the sky had turned a deep, unnatural purple, streaked with jagged bolts of green lightning. The ground trembled, cracks spiderwebbing through the concrete as if the earth itself was fracturing. And then came the signal. It wasn't a broadcast, not in the traditional sense. It bypassed our equipment entirely, resonating through every speaker and screen. Even the air seemed to vibrate with it.
"I am complete."
The voice was unmistakable. God 4 had arrived in full, its presence no longer confined to fragments or glimpses. The facility shook as its resonance intensified. I stumbled into the resonance chamber, compelled by forces beyond my understanding. The machinery was offline, twisted and smoldering from the previous experiments, but the chamber itself remained illuminated. This time, the light wasn't ethereal or shifting. It was absolute, a blinding white consuming everything it touched. In the center of the chamber, a shape coalesced. It was God 4, but it was different, its form no less incomprehensible, but less chaotic, more defined. It radiated power, its surface shimmering like molten glass. The voice returned, louder than ever, shaking the very foundation of the facility.
"All will be purged and made new."
My knees buckled. Around me, the remaining personnel fell to the ground, some screaming, others silent with terror. And then, the destruction began. It was neither dramatic nor immediate, starting with a stillness, an unbearable quiet. A moment later, the walls of the chamber warped, their surfaces rippling as though they were no longer solid. Outside, the world was unraveling. The monitors showed cities disintegrating, structures crumbling into dust as if erased by unseen hands. Across the globe, oceans evaporated, leaving behind cracked, barren basins. But it wasn't just Earth. Far beyond the boundaries of our planet's atmosphere, stars abruptly flickered and died, their light snuffed out in an instant. The universe was collapsing in on itself, folding back into the void from which it had come. And through it all, God 4 remained, its light growing brighter, its voice echoing throughout the abyss. I have no idea how I survived. Perhaps it was happenstance or the result of some deity's twisted mercy. When the light finally faded, I found myself surrounded by desolation. The facility was gone, replaced by an endless expanse of blackened earth. The sky was empty, no stars, no moon, just an infinite void. I stood there for what felt like hours, staring at the nothingness around me. The voice was gone, its presence faded, but its imprint remained, burned into my mind. In the silence, a single thought repeated itself over and over. This isn't the end. It's the beginning. I don't know how long I wandered. Time had lost all meaning. The wasteland stretched endlessly in every direction, an immeasurable expanse of ash and blackened stone beneath a void where the sky had been. There were no signs of life, no landmarks. I was alone. I replayed everything in my mind. The experiments, the fragments, the manifestation of God 4. It all seemed distant, like memories from another lifetime. And yet,
The voice lingered. Even in the silence, I heard it, faint and persistent.
You will bear witness. You will remember.
It was both a command and a curse. I was alive, but for what purpose? To bear the burden of knowledge? To serve as a monument to the end of everything? I had no answers, only questions. Eventually, I found something, or maybe it found me. A shape appeared on the horizon, shimmering faintly against the bleak backdrop. At first, I thought it was a mirage, a trick of my strained mind. But as I drew closer, the shape grew distinct. There, amidst the devastation, stood a structure impossibly pristine. It was a tower, inexplicably tall and narrow, its surface smooth and featureless. It glowed faintly, casting no shadows, as though it existed outside the rules of this broken reality. I felt an irresistible compulsion to approach. My legs carried me forward, each step heavier than the last, until I stood at its base. There was no door, no visible entrance, just the seamless surface of the tower. And yet, as I reached out to touch it, the wall dissolved, opening into a vast, empty chamber. Inside, the air was still and cool, untouched by the decay outside. The walls glimmered, pulsing in a slow, rhythmic pattern that felt oddly familiar. At the center of the chamber stood a pedestal, and upon it, an ancient book, its leather cover cracked and worn. Its title was embossed in gold, the letters faded but legible. The Cycles of God. I approached it cautiously, hesitating, before placing my hand over the cover. Instinctively, I knew that opening the tome would change everything, but I had no other choice. The pages were filled with indecipherable diagrams, symbols, and text. As I turned them, however, their meaning became clear, as though the knowledge was being whispered directly into my mind. The book detailed the now familiar cycles of existence, each one governed by a different iteration of the divine: creation, detachment, compassion, and finally, wrath. The process always ended in destruction, a cleansing of imperfections in preparation for conception. And it was endless, an eternal loop stretching beyond our wildest comprehension. Then, on the final page, I saw Cycle 5. The section was incomplete, the text fragmented, as though even the book had struggled to describe what lay beyond wrath. But one phrase was clear, etched into the margin in trembling script. The cycle breaks. My breath caught. The cycles, I realized, weren't immutable after all. Cycle 5 wasn't simply another iteration. It was unprecedented, unmeasurable, and unfathomable. In possession of this newfound knowledge, a single question came to mind. Was this rebirth a continuation, or were we truly in uncharted territory? I closed the book, and the voice returned.
You are responsible. You will understand.
The tower began to tremble, growing brighter, its light filling every corner of the chamber. I staggered back, shielding my eyes, to no avail. When the light finally faded, I was no longer in the tower. I awoke to the sound of birdsong. For a moment, I thought I was dreaming, but as I opened my eyes, I marveled at the green fields stretching out before me, dotted with trees that swayed gently in the breeze. The sky was blue, the air warm and sweet. I'd been created anew, in a world reborn. But it wasn't our world. The constellations were unfamiliar, their arrangements unbound by the patterns I had studied. The sunlight was too golden, the gravity subtly different.
familiar, yet wholly alien. This was something new. Or was it? My mind churned with memories, excerpts from the cycles of God. Was this the promised renewal, the first act of a new iteration? Or was it, and I, an aberration, a break in a previously eternal loop? In spite of everything, I stood there, serene, taking it all in. It was not the tranquility of closure, but the fragile, trembling peace of uncertainty. Had cycle 5 begun, I wondered, or had the cycles malfunctioned and left me suspended in some sort of limbo? I don't know if this place is heaven, purgatory, or something else entirely. Perhaps it really is the beginning of a fifth cycle, or the absence of order altogether. Whatever the case may be, I am an anomaly, the sole survivor in a world made new. Was this our Creator's final act of wrath, or his first act of mercy? God 4 has gone silent, and the answers elude me. As I stand here, waiting for whatever's next, three questions remain. Who am I responsible to? What have I become? And where is God 5? You've just heard God 4 by Craig Groeschek. Craig Groeschek is the creator and operator of the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, which has grown to nearly 500,000 subscribers, over 3,000 uploads, and more than 69 million video views in its 12 years of operation. He also oversees production of 4 weekly audio horror fiction podcasts, including this one, faithfully adapting and featuring the work of thousands of indie horror authors. A published author himself, dozens of his short stories have been adapted for this channel and other platforms. He holds a bachelor's degree in communication from the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point. In his free time, Groeschek enjoys a wide range of outdoor activities, traveling, and spending time with 3 horror-loving children and his friends. Well, friends, that does it. Story time is now over, and we can all crawl back into our frozen holes for another week. I know these things are relative, but good God, Western New York has been frigid lately. Luckily, things still stay just warm enough with this handy hell portal I keep in my basement. And to think that some idiots call it a liability. I'd like to extend my thanks to Micah Edwards and Craig Groeschek for tonight's stories, and also to you, dear listeners, for stopping by. Be sure to come back next week for more Horror Hill, and until then, stay spooky. You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Tonight's episode was hosted, narrated, scored, and finalized by yours truly, Eric Peabody. Additional music by Nikki McSorley. Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? Email it to us at submissions@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your work considered for future production. If you enjoyed tonight's episode, why not help us spread our dark presence online? You can follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on social media and upvote, subscribe, and hit the bell notification icon if you're listening to this on YouTube. It helps us out a lot and also keeps you up to date on new episodes. If you'd like access to uninterrupted horror, free of ads and these annoying bookend segments, might I recommend signing up to be a patron? You'll get access to hundreds of episodes of this show, as well as everything from the other programs in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights cabal. That means all of Scary Stories Told in the Dark, Drew Blood's Dark Tales, and more. It's a veritable smorgasbord of horrific delights. Head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com to get started. If you're looking for someone to narrate or handle audio production for your own personal project, I just so happen to know a guy.
email me at ericpeabodyvoice@gmail.com and we can talk details. That's ericpeabodyvoice@gmail.com. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.